I have the great honor of introducing our introducer. And I will make it very brief because none of you in the room need an introduction to Max Kampelman. But as the chairman of the board of the U.S. Institute of Peace, I do have to take note of the fact that for close to a decade, Max Kampelman served as the vice chair of our board. He kept us on the straight and narrow. He kept us reminding ourselves constantly of the need to decide how the Institute of Peace was special, keep it close to its congressional mandate, keep us from doing what is all too often done in this town, which is to figure out what everybody else is doing, but rather to do our own thing and to make our own unique contribution and to do it in a way that made us proud to be Americans in a bipartisan basis. Max Kampelman, of course, is the father of many things, not least the CSCE process, which brought us to the end of the Cold War. Max is going to introduce our keynote speaker, Sandy Berger. So without further ado, I'll give the floor to the Honorable Max Kampelman.
Thank you, Chip. If you have something more to say, we have time. No. My task this afternoon is to introduce Sandy Berger to you. You and I and Sandy all know that he needs no introduction to this audience or to any audience. I'm therefore going to take the liberty that comes with age, seniority, and the possession of the microphone to place today's topic in a atmosphere and somehow in a perspective which has not been particularly emphasized so far today. Our world has been experiencing the drama of change since the end of the Second World War, which we militarily used to defeat the fascists. Our military victory in that war produced democracy in Japan, democracy in Germany, and in time, a vision of democracy that spread throughout Europe and in much of the world. Freedom House tells us that today a larger part of the world's population is living in relative freedom than ever before in history. Secretary of State Colin Powell recently defined our national task as helping to make the 21st century the century of democracy. This builds on the leadership provided by Secretary of State Madeleine Albright in the creation in Warsaw of the Community of Democracies, attended by more than 50 foreign ministers, which will have its second meeting later this year in Seoul. There can be no finer or more noble aspiration for our country. And this aspiration is our reason for being as a nation and unites us as a people. And it can cement our relationships with peoples wherever they may live. It is that commitment that justifies our strength as a nation and earns us our leadership. It is understandable and to be anticipated that the change toward modernity and toward democracy produces resistance from those who feel threatened by those changes. And this includes forces and peoples now profiting from arbitrary power, and it also produces resistance from those who believe that the changes threaten their traditions, their mores, their values. And such resistance produces conflict. It's understandable that many would like to avoid conflict, and others seek assurances that we'll win that conflict. International cooperation is logically a means to help provide those assurances. I respectfully suggest, however, that it is not only temporary governments and temporary administrations that one uses to define an international community. Rather, the aspiration of all peoples for human dignity is an integral part of what consists of the cooperation we seek and of the coalition we are always challenged to form. And our goal is consistent with that aspiration. Sandy Berger, throughout his public life, has understood this reality and this strength to human dignity and to human rights values. A successful international lawyer in and out of government who has served our country with discretion in the legislative branch and in the executive branch, has brought experience, good judgment, wisdom, and distinction to his role as National Security Advisor to President Clinton. The New York Times has described him as the most influential National Security Advisor since Henry Kissinger. I'm very pleased and honored to introduce to you today my friend, a man whom I respect deeply, Sandy Berger, to share his views and perspective with us. Sandy.
Thank you very much, Max, for that very eloquent statement about not only the universal aspiration for democracy, but the idea that has animated your life and your career and has marked and continues to characterize your public service. Thank you also to Chet Crocker and Dick Solomon for your leadership. For almost two decades now, USIP has been a strong voice in managing and preventing conflict. The Institute never pretends there are easy answers, but you always ask the right questions. And I'm delighted to be here this afternoon in such distinguished company. We meet at a time of sober reflection, nearly a year since the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. We will never forget what we lost that day. Some 3,000 lives cut short, families shattered, voids created forever. The images of those events are indelibly seared on our minds. September 11th changed our perspective and priorities as a nation, perhaps even as individuals. September 11 shook another feature of the American landscape, one that in no small measure helped shape the 20th century, the American sense of invulnerability. We have been a bountiful continental nation. What Teddy Roosevelt described a century ago as the young giant of the West standing on a continent and clasping the crest of an ocean in either hand. There was, of course, an existential threat to the United States during the Cold War. We built bomb shelters and imagined nuclear winter.
but with few exceptions, the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, for example, the threat at one level was abstract. It did not beset us with questions about how we live our everyday lives. Should I fly today? Is my office building safe? Do I know where my loved ones are? September 11 did. The events that day breached the wall of the unimaginable. Suddenly, planes became terrifying missiles, and anthrax was delivered in our mail. We could conjure any nightmare. We are more conscious of our vulnerability today. But in the past year, the past year should also make us more confident of our resilience. These are uncertain times economically, but September 11 did not unravel our economy. And in the fight against this enemy, the United States has accomplished a good deal in the past 12 months. We collapsed the Taliban regime that gave sanctuary to bin Laden and his camps. We've substantially disrupted, although by no means destroyed, Al-Qaeda. And by responding in a fierce but focused way, directed at the perpetrators and their allies, we frustrated what I believe was the fundamental purpose of bin Laden's attack, to provoke an indiscriminate response that would further polarize the United States and the Islamic world and help bring down regimes from Pakistan to Saudi Arabia in a region of pan-Islamic radicalism. But this threat is hardly behind us, even if you define it in the clearest and sharpest of terms. Defeating a strain of anti-American jihadist fanatics who seek to do us grievous harm. The fight against these terrorists must remain a top American priority for a very long time. In some cases, that will mean targeted military action, alone or with others. In other cases, it depends on intense intelligence and law enforcement cooperation. It also requires that we win the peace in Afghanistan, helping establish a secure environment in which the international community can assist Afghanistan achieve stability and a functioning economy. The events today only underscore the importance of this. In this war, our staying power is as important as our firepower. And there is another critical front to this war, the home front, where we must undergo nothing less than a paradigm shift in our approach to domestic security. In the past, we've pursued an essentially threat-based approach to defending the United States, relying heavily on prior warning, whether that was NORAD or intelligence, which could give us time to respond. Our intelligence capabilities on the terrorist threat, domestic and international, will grow over time. But with this enemy, we can never be fail-safe. Now we need, and are gradually embracing, a vulnerability-based approach. We have to ask, where can they hurt us most, and how can we act now to lower the risks? But if the first fundamental lesson of September 11 was to expose America's vulnerability, there is a second lesson, no less important. The events a year ago also demonstrated, more starkly than anything before, our interdependence. On September 11, the rest of the world came crashing in our door. We now know that even Manhattan is not an island. What happens beyond our borders can immediately and directly affect our lives and well-being. We can't walk away from the world, not least because the world will not walk away from us. And that raises what I believe is a central challenge. Advancing America's interests 1 year later in a world where a clear and present danger from terrorism still exists, but where the safety and well-being of Americans demand that we do much more than defeat terrorism, where our future will be shaped not only by what we destroy, but also by what we build. We must be intensely focused on our determination to defeat this enemy on its turf and ours. But just as focus is important, so too is peripheral vision. Our victory in the war on terror cannot come at the expense of our other priorities, for if it does, we may find ourselves no safer than before. The war on terrorism must be embedded in the larger constellation of U.S. interests. We need, by defining terrorism distinctly, all terrorism is evil, but not all evil is terrorism. Defeating the violent jihadists who want to spill American blood is, by itself, a daunting challenge. If we paint with too broad a brush, if we define the war on terror to embrace an axis of evil, we can lose our focus and credibility on both fronts. Does Saddam Hussein pose a threat to the United States? Yes, especially if he develops nuclear weapons that could embolden him to try again for the regional hegemony he seeks, misguided by the notion that this time we would hesitate. But based on what we know today, linkages with terrorists directed against the United States, past and potential, are unclear at best. And even if we displace it, there are numerous other countries that could supply terrorists with deadly weaponry. That is not to say that we can ignore the threat Saddam poses, and new linkages may appear, but we undermine our authority if we are seen as shoehorning a complicated issue into a simple rationale. If we conclude that regime change is the right end, as I believe, then there's a right way and a wrong way. The right way leaves the region and the world more secure. It proceeds on a timetable dictated by the trajectory of the threat. It permits us neither to be dulled into perpetual inaction nor rushed into precipitous action. It faces up to a heavy price, a long stay, and the dangers of acting alone. The wrong way could leave friends like Jordan destabilized, Israel imperiled, even a radical regime in Islamabad with a ready-made nuclear arsenal, and could lose us essential international support against the terrorist enemy all of us acknowledge. That is why we must do more than simply plan a military invasion. We need the building blocks that can make long-term success possible. And that includes making the case to others of the legitimacy of our actions. Today, even many of our closest allies do not share our sense of the threat. Some in the United States say, so what? Our allies are weak militarily and soft strategically. And as for those in the region, others say, in effect, if we do it, they will come. Well, to some degree, I agree that the exercise of power is self-reinforcing. Strength is respected, and weakness is exploited. But in such a challenging undertaking as Iraq, our strategy cannot rest on such an assumption. We have suffered in an earlier war from the arrogance of power. Let us not build a war plan for Iraq based on the power of arrogance. As we use the hard edge of American power to protect ourselves from terrorists and aggressors who imperil our interests, our national interests also require that we lead with equal energy across a broader agenda, one that isolates the extremists, not ourselves. In this interconnected world, we must use and be seen as using our power to build a less bitter and divided world, not simply because it is important to our security, but because it defies those who foment anger at the United States that they believe is self-absorbed. We will win the fight against terror only if we also tackle other threats to our shared well-being, if our leadership is defined not only by what we're against, but also by what America is for. And I want to explore these two points briefly further. First, the purpose of American power, and second, the broad agenda for American leadership 1 year later. With all of our challenges, this is a time of unparalleled opportunity for the United States. By almost any definition, we stand at the apex of our power. Our economy is twice as large as that of our closest ally, Japan. The posters on the dorm walls at Beijing University are of Michael Jordan, not of Mao Zedong. Our political system, while hardly perfect, remains a beacon to millions of people around the world, our values of democracy and freedom. We spend more on defense today than the next 25 countries combined. That power, our power, is a blessing. It is built on sweat and sacrifice. It helps define us in the world for better and for worse. If we use our power only for self-protection and in a manner that is self-righteous, we fuel the fires of resentment. If we also use our power with others to advance our shared well-being, we earn influence, respect, and moral authority that raw power can never purchase. Power gains legitimacy by the purpose to which it is applied and the manner in which it is exercised. This isn't simply a question of unilateralism versus multilateralism. We acted essentially unilaterally in Afghanistan, and the world accepted our military actions as legitimate, as a legitimate response to the provocation. There will always be causes worth fighting for, and there are times when we will be compelled to act alone. But if we fail to build support for whatever we do in Iraq, if we accept transatlantic drift as inevitable or even inconsequential, rather than build the U.S.-European alliance as the anchor of our security, if we turn our backs on international arrangements from Kyoto to the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, rather than stay and improve them, if when longtime allies like Argentina face life and death crisis, we not only throw up our hands but appear to throw down the gauntlet, if we do these things, we isolate ourselves, not those who seek to do us harm. Freedom of action is not always preferable to collective action. And while America will always do what it must to protect our people, we lead best by building coalitions around us. In short, the fight against terrorism 1 year later must remain at the very heart of our agenda, but it cannot be the whole agenda. Even as we chart our course on Iraq, we must address this broader agenda for America in the world, the range of challenges and opportunities that lie before us. Let me suggest five. First, how, beyond Iraq, do we deal with the spread of the most dangerous weapons into the most volatile regions and into the most irresponsible hands? In recent months, some have talked of a new doctrine of preemption, hitting them before they hit us. Certainly, every country reserves the right to act preemptively in unique circumstances of danger. But it would be a mistake to elevate this from an option reserved for unique circumstances to a doctrine we espouse in a broad context. Doing so risks lowering the threshold of use, as each actor in a crisis is tempted to act first to use or lose. And the broader the application we give to such a policy, the greater justification we give to other nations in dangerous regions like the Middle East or South Asia to use it as a pretext for attacking enemies. There's no silver bullet that eliminates the ominous spread of weapons of mass destruction, but the United States must lead a wide-ranging global effort to reduce these threats. We should seek to strengthen international regimes like the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the Chemical Weapons Convention, and lend our weight, not walk away, from the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty and the Biological Weapons Enforcement Protocol. It's become fashionable to suggest that such treaties do more harm than good. But when the NPT came into force in 1970, it was widely believed that there would be 20 to 30 nuclear weapon states within 20 years. Instead, there are 8. And governments including Brazil, South Africa, South Korea, Argentina, Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Taiwan have given up nuclear weapons programs. The international norm has mattered. International treaties with viable inspection regimes won't eliminate cheating, but they give us greater transparency, establish the baseline of appropriate international behavior, and enable us to rally international support when the norm is not observed. We also must secure the most dangerous nuclear material at its source. Enough nuclear material in Russia to make 60,000 nuclear warheads, inadequately stored and safeguarded. I commend the President for leading the G8 and committing up to $20 billion over the next 10 years towards securing weapons and materials around the world, particularly in Russia. Now we must make that happen. In addition, particularly against a shadowy, stateless terrorist enemy, we must strengthen our defenses against WMD terrorist attack in the United States. It's a delicate balance here at home, anticipating the unspeakable without speaking like an alarmist. But denial is not an option. The better prepared we are to detect and respond to insidious attacks, the less likely we are to confront them. Second, America must use its influence to be a peacemaker, seeking to diffuse, if not resolve, enduring conflicts that often fuel the forces of terrorism. We must finish the job in the Balkans, test whether engagement and deterrence can work in Korea, and continue to pursue our unique opportunity to help the parties in South Asia toward dialogue. The overriding challenge, however, remains the Middle East. There is no stable status quo. A strategy of terror is suicide for the Palestinians. Israel will do what it believes it must to control violence. But there is no durable security for Israel through military action alone. Every president since Richard Nixon has recognized that the United States has an essential and active role to play to control this conflict. After nearly 2 years of growing bloodshed, bitterness, and distrust, do not expect a bolt from the blue. But only the United States, on the ground, with our sleeves rolled up, can stitch opportunity out of exhaustion, orchestrating reciprocal steps that reverse the deadly momentum. And only with U.S. leadership can the physics of the situation be changed, so that those Palestinians who seek a necessary change of leadership and direction are propelled forward by a concrete picture we portray of what is on the other side of the mountain if they give up on violence and genuinely respect the existence of a Jewish state. This conflict is not self-correcting. If we stand aside, we increase the chance it will breed a bitter new generation that sees America not as part of the solution, but as part of the problem. Third, we need to offer leadership on the crisis in emerging countries, starting with our own hemisphere. From Argentina to Venezuela, South America is headed toward turmoil. This is not a simple matter. The orthodoxy of the 80s and 90s, open markets and investment, external support, discipline in times of crisis, has had mixed results at best. From 1980 to 2000, per capita incomes in Latin America grew hardly at all and declined in Africa. Even in Mexico, a hemispheric success story, per capita income today is only slightly higher than it was in 1980. Last month, the Treasury Secretary, in response to a question in Argentina on why Latin Americans were rejecting privatization, open markets, and foreign investment, said, "I have no idea." His candor is refreshing. It is refreshing. But I would feel better if it were accompanied by a restless energy to lead the effort to find the right role for the international community in a weak but inexorably globalizing world economy, to search for the right balance of social investment and economic liberalization. We have learned over recent years that elections do not automatically produce responsive governments, that globalization without a safety net can be a windfall for the few and a free fall for the many. Open trade and investment are indispensable, but they are not sufficient. 1 billion people on Earth today live on the knife's edge of survival. 65 million people will perish from AIDS by the year 2020 unless we change the course of history. That is more than six every minute. We indeed may look back on this moment of history as much for what we did or did not do on AIDS as on terrorism. America cannot be safe in a world where the gap between rich and poor is growing wider. Trade Promotion Authority is an important step, but trade by itself will not pull struggling nations out of poverty. We must close the gap between what is spent and what is needed to prevent a world that is bitterly and violently divided a generation from now. The fourth challenge is to continue to integrate our former adversaries, Russia and China, into the international community. These are truly historic opportunities after a half century of costly and dangerous standoff. But the future is not preordained. China is engaged in the boldest economic experiment in human history. To take a poor, largely rural, collective society of 1.2 billion people and transform it into a largely middle-class, increasingly urban society driven by the economics of the marketplace. But can it also develop the rule of law and growing pluralism that are essential to cushion and distribute the cost and benefits of dislocation and change in a peaceful and stable fashion? Russia has a leader who understands its weakness and is compelled by modernization. But will the need for order come at the cost of dissent? Will Russia's economic expansion come at the expense of its neighbors? In the first instance, of course, these issues will be resolved by the Chinese and the Russians. But our posture matters. Either respectful and principled, or dismissive and one-sided. Finally, we must bring a greater sense of urgency today to the environment we are leaving to the future. We know that global temperatures are rising. 9 of the 10 warmest years on record have occurred since 1990. Climate change will alter the way we live, as sea levels rise and weather grows more extreme. Denial is a risky strategy. If Kyoto is flawed, we should use our influence to fix it. A rising tide will sink all the boats. At the end of the day, meeting these and other challenges depends in no small measure on whether and how America leads in the world. We must prevail in our campaign against terrorism. But we can neither define all threats as terrorism nor our only threat as terrorism. There is no reason to apologize for American power. To an extraordinary degree, it has been harnessed over time to good, not ill, to freedom, not repression. But power does not guarantee success. That depends on how we use it to shape the forces that are transforming the world. Our purpose always must be to advance America's interests and values. But more and more, our challenges are global and their solutions must be cooperative. We are more likely to earn others' support for our priorities when we show respect for theirs. We are more likely to shape the outcome of events when we're in the game rather than on the sidelines. And when it comes to addressing the problems that challenge our common humanity, the more America pulls its weight, the greater will be our reward, not only in a better, more peaceful world, but the authority we command within it. If we summon that strength and vision today, if we are unrelenting but not overreaching, if we preserve our confidence, our decency, our values, Americans will stay together, the world will stay together, and we will emerge even stronger. Thank you.